on this episode of Skeptico.
So when some people encounter certain circle-making teams and they ask them pointed questions about, well, what about this formation and what about that formation, they will, on purpose, they will actually say, oh, yeah, yeah, we couldn't make that one. No, no, definitely not. No. They actually foster and pretend and play. It's almost like theatre for them. The whole crop circle thing for them is making a crop circle, a really good one, and then pretending like, well, actually, yeah, that's the one we couldn't have made. That's too good for us.
I've talked to a number of people that all say the same thing, is that there's this real resistance from BLT when it comes to just doing simple blinding. And in this case, it's not hard to double blind, right?
Okay, I get what you're saying. But first of all, I mean, you don't know a lot of stuff. So let me tell you a few things. Levingood, who did all of the early plant work, probably couldn't have been much blinder than he was.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I return to a topic that's been haunting me for a while. You know, I'm from Chicago, and like any city or area, the place you come from has a certain set of values that naturally get ingrained into you. And for me, and for a lot of people from Chicago, one of those values is best summed up by the phrase, don't be a chump. For someone from Chicago, about the worst thing that can happen to you is to be played for the fool, the chump. So a couple of years ago when I interviewed Suzanne Taylor about her movie on crop circles and about her investigation into the crop circle phenomena, I got played for a chump. I bought into Suzanne's story without fully investigating it. I bought into her claim that no imperfect crop circle or incomplete crop circle had ever been found, and that the phenomena was truly shrouded in mystery. Now, thanks to you, Skeptico listeners, I was able to be re-educated relatively quickly by folks who posted all the work that's been done by people with a more skeptical perspective on crop circles. But all of this is relatively old news, both to the general public that has moved on from crop circles and for me, who has moved on from crop circle investigation very much. That is until I heard from today's guest, Nancy Talbot. Nancy is one of the best-known crop circle investigators. She claims to have adhered to very tight scientific protocols and investigated this thoroughly from a scientific perspective. She claims to have peer-reviewed papers to back up her work. And when she popped up on my Facebook and started messaging me, I responded. I told her my skepticism. I told her how I had gone down this path and felt like there really wasn't much there to investigate. But she persisted and convinced me that I needed to take a second look, and in particular, I needed to look at her work. So we set up this interview, and we did it, and you're going to hear some of that in just a minute. I also interviewed a well-known crop circle maker in the UK, Matt Williams. Now, there's this real feud between people like Suzanne and people like Nancy Talbot, Matt Williams. They see him as a debunker, as someone who's out to denigrate the whole crop circle phenomena. So I talked to Matt to get a different perspective. Then I went back and talked to Nancy again. Then I went back and talked to Matt again. I did a lot of interviews on this, more than I think I've done on any topic in a long, long time. So what I've tried to do in this show is kind of distill it down to, I think, the skeptico essence of what's going on here. So I'm going to present to you part of the interview that I did with Nancy, because I think that's all that's really significant. Then I'm going to present part of the interview that I did with Matt that I think counters Nancy's position. And then I'm going to post in a separate interview the full interview with Matt, which I think is really interesting. It's long, but it does cover a lot of ground and a lot of different territory. And I felt like if I included it in this interview, it would dilute the main point that I'm trying to bring forward about crop circle science. So let's get started first with my interview with Nancy Talbot. Today we welcome crop circle researcher Nancy Talbot to Skeptico. Nancy is one of the co-founders of BLT Research, the T in there being originally from Talbot. And she's one of the best known researchers in this field, and her group, BLT, is certainly one of the best known research groups in this field. Nancy, thank you so much for joining me on Skeptico. It's great to have you on.
I'm delighted. Thanks very much for asking, Alex.
So I want to give folks a little bit of a background, and I want to give you a little bit of background as well, because this topic is a little bit outside of the realm of what we normally cover on Skeptico. Skeptico is a show primarily about consciousness research. So we've done a lot of shows on near-death experience, after-death communication, psychedelics, and all this science that leads us to the extended consciousness realm. And when I say science, we've tried to stay pretty close to top researchers, major universities, peer review stuff. But every once in a while, I venture out of that a little bit. And last year, a Skeptico listener suggested that I talk to crop circle investigator and film producer Suzanne Taylor. And even though I wasn't very well versed on crop circles, I had Suzanne on. We had a nice chat, and I was very open to the crop circle phenomena, probably because, like I say, I've done so much with the extended consciousness realms, and there's a lot of controversy. But I've found that, you know, when you really stick to the science, there's something there. There's a reality to near-death experience. There's a reality to after-death communication, all that stuff. So I was open to it. But where I really got hammered, and this is one of the great things about this show, is when I published that show, I got a lot of feedback from listeners who were educating me and saying, hey, look, this crop circle thing isn't what you think it is. There's all these man-made crop circles. There's these circle makers that have filmed what they've done, and the crop circle researchers haven't been able to tell a real crop circle, real being in quotes, from a man-made crop circle. And so I actually went back to Suzanne and pushed her on some of this and said, hey, you know, I'm at fault for not researching this prior to my interview, but couldn't you have given me a better heads up here? This is not the field that you kind of portrayed to me. And that's where I kind of left things. I'm still very much skeptical of the scientific claims on crop circles, but it was really interesting to have you pop up on my Facebook page, and I appreciate that. And I shared with you a little bit of my skepticism, but then I thought it'd be a great opportunity to kind of wrestle this thing to the ground. So great to have you on to do that.
Well, maybe we can get it a little closer to the ground. Not sure I can answer everything here, but there's a lot of scientific work, and some of it is peer-reviewed, and there's an X-ray diffraction study that is incredible, so go at it.
Okay, well, you know, I have to say, from a 10,000-foot view, the first thing that I did when I was investigating this, after I went through this process and had my doubts and tried to get more serious about investigating it, the first thing that I did was Google double-blind study, because what this immediately reminds me of is the assisted after-death communication research, basically medium research. So you go see a medium, they talk to your dead relative. That is just kind of pillared by the skeptics for the longest time. They've said that's impossible, that's ridiculous, it's unscientific. Well, on this show, anyone who's listened to it knows that we've interviewed probably the person who's the best researcher in that, Dr. Julie Beischel from the University of Arizona, PhD, pharmacology, really knows what she's doing, put together the gold standard research for that. But it's all about blinding and control. And when you look at that in the crop circle field, there's none of that. There's no double blind work. And as a matter of fact, I think you're...
Now, wait a sec. Gotta interrupt you. Do you understand when and where the double-blind approach is actually used in science.
Well, as I just explained, I think in talking to Dr. Beischel, who's done a quadruple-blind, and as well as talking to numerous other researchers like Cambridge biologist Rupert Sheldrake, who's had to undergo the same kind of scrutiny, I mean, I think I'm pretty familiar with the double-blinding. And in this case, it's not hard to double-blind, right?
Now, what it means, what a double-blind study really means, is that you've narrowed down a causative agent to one particular thing. And then is the time when you begin to do double-blind work. In exploratory work, it's completely inappropriate. I mean, you'd never get anywhere.
Not at all. I mean, blinding is just a control mechanism. The idea of a blubber...
No. The double-blind study means very specifically something.
A double-blind study, for example, in pharmacology means something very specific. But blinding is just a basic scientific control that can be instituted in any experiment. And in this case, the simple fact is, as you know, one of the people that you get when you Google that is Colin Andrews, who says, hey, in 1995, I tried to send samples to Nancy, to BLT, and say, collected independently, and say, you know, here are the samples. One's from a field that we presume to be alien. Another is from a field that just is subjected to wind damage. Independently collected samples, photographed, videotaped, so they know they're independent. Send them to you. You evaluate them. I've talked to a number of people, including, you know, I talked to crop circle maker Matthew Williams, who I know you don't feel very fondly of, but I've talked to a number of people that all say the same thing, is that there's this real resistance from BLT when it comes to just doing simple blinding and seeing if your techniques...
Wait a second. I get what you're saying, but first of all, I mean, you're complete, you don't know a lot of stuff. So let me tell you a few things. Levingood, who did all of the early plant work, probably couldn't have been much blinder than he was, except for a couple of cases where he actually went himself, you know, to the fields and helped with the sampling and stuff like that, or where he and I together had done it, or where John Burke was also involved. Levingood didn't have the faintest idea when circle samples would arrive at his door, I was the person who was arranging the majority of the sampling, had figured out a field protocol because I wanted things done in a certain way and repeatedly, you know, regularly done, to rule out any sort of a field personnel bias, you know. And it was I who was deciding, Levingood had nothing to do with this, which circles would be sampled. And I randomized that also. Every year, known only to me, not to him or John Burke or the samplers, I would decide that every fourth circle I heard about, or every eighth, or every tenth, or whatever, in that particular season, we would then sample, regardless of what it looked like and what country it was in. And I used, as samplers, some were crop circle enthusiasts, some were hired agricultural reps, people who represent various, you know, seed companies and whatever. Then there were a number of people who were not particularly interested in the crop circle thing, but were agronomists or in some way associated with, you know, plant production. And then there were just people who were anything, any background, you know, with, in fact, there were some UFO people interested in UFOs. Point is that what I'm trying to say is that the sampling, the breadth of samplers was considerable, and there was a consistent field protocol that was followed, not in every case, of course, but generally, which was then followed. Now, in most of these cases abroad, I was not present. John wasn't present. Levengood was in his lab. And so we didn't know for sure, you know, we had to take it on faith that when one of these samplers from whatever country had followed the instructions supposedly that I'd sent and sent these plants and whatever to us, they would eventually come. It would take a while because when they come from overseas, you have to dry them down and everything before they can be shipped because of, you know, mold. But they'd eventually arrive at Levengood's lab directly from the field, from whoever had done the work. And Levengood didn't have the faintest idea other than what was on the piece of paper, the sampling guide that was, you know, included. I mean, they could have come from anywhere. And in some cases, it turned out they did. In other words, people didn't always do what they said they had done, because there were some people who were didn't trust him and didn't trust that he was following a you know, that he was doing real work. And so when you talk about being blind, he was completely, and as was I in many of these cases.
I hear what you're saying. Let me back up for people, because I did jump in the middle of this, and that's okay, but let me back up and explain some of these people. When you're talking about Levengood, you're talking, explain who he is and what role he played at BLT before his passing away. And then I guess we ought to talk in basic terms about what you think you've discovered, which is anomalous conditions in these plants that you don't think can be explained by other means. And I guess that would provide people a basis for understanding what this.
If I give you a basic outline of how we went about it and why we went about it the way we did and what we think we found and what we think it means, then you've got a much better picture before you start. One of the things, just for your own thought process, imagine for a second actually trying to create the double-blind situation when it comes to a crop circle. You'd have to know when the genuine crop circle was going to occur, number one. You'd have to know where exactly it was going to occur. You'd have to have some method of making, creating simultaneously. If you're going to do this double blind, this is what double blind means. You're going to have to simultaneously be able to create the same crop circle in crop that exactly resembles, you know, the nature, the constituents in the soil in that field, you know, whatever, the slope of the hill, everything. All of that has to be replicated precisely.
Not really.
Nancy. In order for you then to have what is actually a double-blind study. And then you would sample the one that came down, you don't know how, and the one that you somehow were able to replicate at the same, in the same time frame, the same crop, the same soil conditions, the same plants, you know, and the same design, same size and design and everything. That's when you could actually do a double-blind study. And I can't for the life of me see, given in crop circle situation, how that would be possible. Actually now, because of Robert Vandenbroek, I can conceive of maybe how it could be possible, because he often knows, almost always knows, when they're coming. And if we could set up some very fancy arrangement, you know, with him, and he got a knowing at a certain, giving us enough time to get to the same place with all the stuff you'd need to make one, blah, 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 you know, maybe then we could do something where we would have one that was created by whatever creates it.
But Nancy, it's not that hard. I mean, you're suggesting that you have a way of analyzing crop circles that shows this anomalous condition. So
no, but you don't understand that plants are very complex.
No, but I understand this. Whatever testing you're going to do, you're already doing that testing, and you're claiming that you're able to identify plants with this anomalous condition.
So correct.
The only thing you need is a control that shouldn't do that. Well, there shouldn't be plants in your control group that exhibit those same conditions. You know what I mean? If there's plants that are wind damaged, if they're wind damaged, or if somebody steps on them or
there
puts
are
a board.
Reasons when it's complicated. I understand
it's
what you're saying.
It's not complicated.
Let's start again with me just outlining basically what it is we've done and why. And maybe as you follow along, you'll see that it in living, you know, substances like plants, it's not quite as simple as I think you may think it is. But should we start again with that? Just who Dr. Who Levengood, not doctor. Oh God, even I do it sometimes. Who Levengood is, who Burke was, etc.
Well, he did present himself as a doctor in many documents, and he wasn't a doctor, which is always kind of a bad
sign. I didn't
sign.
Do that.
I didn't say you did. I said he presented himself, signed documents.
Towards the end of his life when he was suffering from, don't put this on the air here, but he was
suffering. Just leave it, we'll just leave it at that, towards the end of his life.
He had Alzheimer's, and at that, that's one of the reasons why I had to break with him when that started to be a thing, you know, where he insisted that. And I said, I can't do it. It's not, we can't do that. That's not right. And it became more and more a big deal to him. And so in 2002, he and I parted company because I didn't want to undo all of the good work he'd already done. And I knew it would. If in fact I continued working with him under those conditions, which I knew were not true by that time, you know, I always call him Lefty, but in public, in the very first couple of years before I found out, because it was John Burke who found it out, before I realized he didn't have a PhD, I'd been told by Linda Howe that he was Dr. Levengood. And it never occurred to me that she would lie. She knew he wasn't, but she still calls him Doctor. And so I didn't know, and it wasn't until John Burke double-checked his credentials and found that, no, he had the MA and the MS from University of Michigan, but no PhD. And then John immediately told me. But by then, I had already done one or two public things in which I had called him doctor. The instant I discovered that that was not so, I informed every single one of our field workers, every contact I had. And I made it very clear. That's why if you look on the BLT website under professional consultants, you will see all the credentials of everybody that we've worked for, what universities, what years they graduated, whatever degrees they have, etc. And under Levengood's entry, it's very clear that he has the MS and the MA, but no PhD.
Fair
and
enough.
I couldn't do a thing to help him in his old age when he fantasized, I guess.
That's fair enough. I mean, when someone misrepresents their credentials, I've had that happen to me on Skeptico, and it's good if you can vet everyone, but you can't. So all you can do is correct it as soon as you find out.
I correct it every time it comes up now.
Which it sounds like you did. But, you know, I mean, back to the big picture kind of thing, and we can talk about that, but I take it up even my journey into this. You know, it just seems like the crop circle researchers, the main complaint is that we now know a lot of these crop circles are man-made. People have videotaped themselves making.
Well, now, wait a second. We're not talking about all the other researchers. You're talking to me. And so you're interested in talking to me.
If you want to talk about you, we can talk
about
you.
I want to talk about our work.
That's fine. But I think you've also been unable to discern beforehand whether a crop circle is man-made or whether it is not man-made. And that's really the issue. I say when it's now is revealed.
I'm afraid that I don't agree with you.
You are able
and
to
determine.
And if
you'll let me tell you some of why I think we do know what we're talking about, I would, you know, that's what
I thought
we were going to be
about. I'll get off the mic here and let you do that. But let's just make sure you understand that. You're going to tell me that you are able to discern whether a crop circle is man-made.
I'm going to tell you that I think we can almost always, if we do the tests, which I personally have been involved in and have done some of them and know exactly what they're supposed to show, when we do all of those tests on any given situation, I'm as close to certain that they are accurately telling us the difference between a mechanically flattened crop circle and one that has not been mechanically flattened, which occurs in whatever, by whatever causative agency this is that we're dealing with. I don't claim, and I've never claimed that I can tell in every single one or that Levin good could. I've claimed that what we try to do is focus on the physical changes that we know we've observed and documented in crop circles in many countries, not just England. Good God, no. We have known for years that there were huge numbers of man-made formations in England. And because of that, and also because of the, well, not just the expense, because I went to lots of other countries, but we worked on them in Germany, in Sweden, in Norway, in Holland, in Belgium, in France, in Italy, Australia, Israel, the South America, Canada, I mean, you know, all over the place. And when you find certain consistent abnormalities in the samples, as opposed to the controls, taken from the same fields but at varying distances outside, you then begin to have some confidence that those particular physical abnormalities are related to the genuine phenomenon, particularly when you can replicate those effects in the lab yourself. Because, of course, Levin Good came up with a theory, an idea as to how they were occurring. Now, his theory has been modified by the X-ray diffraction study that we did, but the physical changes that have been most frequently observed include this apical node elongation, which is stretching of the top node in the plant, expulsion cavities, which are holes blown out farther down the plant stem node, usually in the second, but sometimes in the second, third, and fourth, both of which are occurring, he believed, that makes sense to me, because of exposure to extremely brief nanosecond bursts of intense microwave radiation, which heat up the moisture inside the plant stem, turning it instantly to steam. The steam has to, you know, escape somehow. It expands, of course. And the uppermost part of the plant, the top node, is the youngest part, and it is the most elastic. The tissue there is the most elastic. And so when the moisture in the node, the top node, is hit with the microwaves, it expands, but it stretches the node and literally just seeps out. And when it's gone, when the steam is gone, you're left with an elongated node. Farther down the plant stem, the external fibers are too tough. They do not stretch. They will not. And therefore, when the steam builds up in those nodes, they simply explode. They cause these holes to be exploded at these lower nodes. Now, expulsion cavities don't occur in every circle that we have thought was genuine. And we believe the difference is due to the type of crop involved in some cases, the age of the crop at the time the crop circle occurred, its maturity level, the amount of moisture inside the plant at the time the crop circle occurs, and also the intensity level and or duration of the microwave exposure. Many factors there which seem to be responsible for whether or not we get expulsion cavities.
Right.
But then we have the entire, I mean, those are the only two visible plant changes. There's a whole range of other stuff that goes on. The next most critical are the seedling growth trials, the germination trials. And what is done in this situation is that seeds are taken from a variety of sample plants, as they are from a variety of controls. And it took us some time, but we eventually discovered that there was a spillover effect in many crop circles, not all, but many. And the more complex they were, the more likely this was to be found, which meant that the controls had to be certain that you had a control. you had to be at least, I would say, 50 yards away. And so, you know, each year as we went along, we learned more, and so it modified the approach a little bit. But let's say we've got some real controls, a good 50, 60, 70 yards away, and a number of plants. We take the seeds out of both, and then they're simply placed in a germination chamber, the same number of sample seeds as control seeds, exposed to exactly the same amount of, you know, water every day, light exposure, et cetera, et cetera. And then the root and the shoot development are measured regularly. Usually, Levin Good would begin at around 4 days, sometimes then again at 7, then at 10. By around 15, 16, 17 days germination, if the plant, if the seed is actually germinating and the plant's beginning to grow, they get too big for the tray. And so at that point, he would stop. But what we found was that when the circles occurred in immature crop, where the seed either was not formed at all or had just begun to form, the growth habit, the seeds never matured. They simply did not develop normally. And when you tried to germinate them, they either would not germinate at all, or they would germinate only partially and with a lacking vigor. And those kinds of plants, those kinds of seedlings, if then planted in the field, would not have survived. And so...
So Nancy, I tell you what, you have a tremendous amount of this kind of research. People can find it on the BLT website and go through it. Nice pictures and all of that. But to me, it seems kind of simple. What you're saying is that what I would deduce from that is that if you identify a particular field, and you could then say with a certain degree of certainty that that field has these kind of anomalous characteristics to the plant. And then
you're talking about a crop circle now, not a field.
A field with a crop circle in it. Okay, a crop circle. Good, that's fine. That's a good distinction. So have you ever gone through that process, identified a field, publicly stated that that field you believe to be a genuine quote-unquote crop circle, and then had a circle maker, a man-made circle maker, come out and say, no, that field was constructed by us? Has that ever happened?
I don't think that any... I'm not willing on the record, because it's very nasty, to speak about one thing in particular. But generally, nobody, I mean, the hoaxers all the time, they claim that none of the BLT work is meaningful. I mean, they ignore it all. They say it's all baloney.
But you understand why I asked the question, because that gets down to the heart of it, whether there is...
No, it doesn't, because you don't know what you're talking about here, Alex. There is a particular thing that you do not know about.
Okay, tell me what is that particular thing? I would think if you identify a circle and say this circle exhibits anomalous characteristics, and then someone can prove that that circle was man-made, that kind of blows your theory that you have these anomalous characteristics.
It would definitely do that if, in fact, it depends on when in the stage of development of the work, because we modified, or Levengood modified, the work that he did, as he went along and learned more. I mean, things would be changed. At first, in the very, very beginning, he was using microscopic analysis of the node tissue and looking at changes there, which he thought were significant or highly significant. And he later moved on to quite a while. I mean, when you start doing something brand new with living material, it takes a while to figure out what are the things to look for. So, at which point in the development of the work, the sophistication of the work, has something to do with how authoritative some of his very early stuff, I don't think even he thought was. And it also depends on whether the individual who is reading the report actually understands what it says.
Well, I want to thank Nancy Talbot for joining me today on Skeptico. That was a tense interview at times, but as you know from listening to the show, I don't mind that sometimes when you really dig into issues that you care about and the other person cares about. It gets a little tense, maybe a little testy at times. That's okay. I guess one of the things that really set me off, if you will, is Nancy's insistence that it's so complicated. You know, I've heard that so many times. If you've listened to this show, you've heard it. And I love the story that we recently heard from science writer John Horgan. And John talked about when he was at the beginning stages of his career as a science writer, he kind of went and dutifully sat at the feet of the white-coated scientist and took down everything they're saying. And it took him a couple years to realize that they were bullshitting when they said how complicated things are. And that's been my experience. You know, the smartest and brightest people that I've interviewed, and you've heard so many of them on this show, they make complicated topics simple. Because at the end of the day, science is simple. It's supposed to explain nature in a way that we can understand it. That's the whole purpose. And the flip side of that is invariably, time and time again, people that insist it's complicated turn out to be trying to hide something or turn out to not really know what they're talking about. But in this case, my point for Nancy was that at the end of the day, she has a test. She's developed a test where she says she can tell if a crop circle exhibits signs of anomalous characteristics that can only be associated with ET. Now, that's a little bit of a stretch at the end, but that's basically what she's saying. She's saying, hey, sometimes I find these plant anomalies, and they're so strange, so out of the ordinary, that they couldn't be created any other way that we can explain. Hey, great. I'm all for such a test. That's a pretty simple proposition. What would we expect to see from a test like that? Well, if we break it down in science terms, I guess we could probably tolerate a lot of false negatives in a test like that. So if I sent her a bunch of samples of what I thought were genuine crop circles and she kept coming back and on a lot of them said, no, I don't see anything anomalous. I don't see anything anomalous. That would probably be okay. But if we sent her samples and she came back with false positives, that is, she came back from a sample and said, wow, this is really anomalous. And then we could show her that we've carefully collected those samples and they were collected from a field that I had manipulated with a board or had been blown over with the wind or in any other natural way, then we'd have to say that her test and her theory and her proposition has not been met. Now, that's all I think this is. It's pretty simple. And if she's been at this for 20 years and she doesn't have a test that can conclusively, repeatedly deliver statistically significant results on that, then I don't know where she's going with this. I don't know what she's talking about with all the complexity and all the stuff that everyone doesn't understand about her deep research. And I think that's also the frustration and the pushback that I've heard from some people in the circle-making community. And in particular, with this next guest who you're going to hear that I talked to, and I actually talked to him a couple of times, his name is Matt Williams. He's from the UK. He has the notorious claim of being the only person arrested for making crop circles, which he was. And he has a very different perspective on what's going on here. A very interesting, deep, shaded perspective that I think many people who do a drive-by of the crop circle phenomena don't really get. So it was really neat to talk to Matt. I talked to him a couple of times, and I'm going to play this interview for you now. I want to let you know that I'm going to have both of these interviews, the full interviews, available for download. I won't include them in the feed because I'm just trying to kind of hone in on this topic in a certain way and kind of wrestle it to the ground. But the full interviews, both Nancy's interview and Matt's interview, there's a lot of stuff in there. I think some of it's interesting. I think some of Nancy's stuff is also interesting when she talks about some of the other anomalous paranormal stuff that she's experienced. I don't question any of that, but I just do question the science part. But I guess I've hammered on that enough. Here, let's hear from Matt now. Okay, so, you know, as I mentioned last time, I feel like I'm kind of paying penance here for a story that I got wrong the first time. Then again, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes it's good to get stuff wrong. It keeps the humility index kind of down there where it needs to be. And it also, you know, the thing I've found is that when I take a wrong turn or maybe get the story wrong, like I feel like I did when I first talked to Suzanne Taylor on this, it helps me see potholes in the road, you know, that we can all fall into. And that's what I think I want to do with this show, is kind of take people through what I've discovered as I've looked into this more and more, because I think that a lot of other people are going to do a drive-by on crop circles, even though it's old news for a lot of folks. It's still going to pop up, and people are going to do a quick drive-by, and they're going to miss, I think, the real story that is here. So a part of that, I think a large part of it, has to do with the background of the players involved. And since I have you here with us, Matt, let's start with your background, because I think everyone gets the Matthew Williams circle maker, only person ever arrested for making circles. And then you might scratch a little deeper and you come across this guy from, you're a Welshman, right?
I am indeed.
And, you know, a little bit rough, sarcastic, comes a little caustic on some of these videos.
Expletives, yes.
And I think people get that. But I also get, you know, if you watch the rest of your videos, I get a sense of someone who can definitely come across as a very coherent, well-spoken. I saw you on the Edge TV show. You seemed extremely reasonable, well-spoken, all that stuff. But I think, you know, people see these other videos. They see another side of you. They run across Truth Seeker 666. He's associated with these other circle makers, Team Satan. And people are immediately going, oh, whoa, wait a minute. What am I kind of getting into? So I think it's worth just kind of taking a step back. And, you know, in a minute, we'll talk about your background as a paranormal investigator, which I think is really, really interesting. But if we left that out of the story right now, what is it that you think people misunderstand about you as a circle maker?
Well, people like to make assumptions about the fact that because you're making circles, by default, you must be a negative person. And really, everything I've done with Circle Makers TV, the thing I did on the internet, was to kind of show that we are normal people, that we have pretty much normal lives. Probably a lot more of the Circle Makers have even more normal lives than me. You know, they've got jobs and kids and families and all sorts of stuff like that. You know, me, okay, I'm a single guy. You know, people could throw this at me and say, oh, he's just a weird single guy, lives on his own. He's called Truth Seeker 666. This means he's all negative. And it's like, well, actually, the reason for Truth Seeker 666, if you look on my videos, on the very first page, on the channel page, there is a video called Why Is This Called Truth Seeker 666? And I explain it. And
It's a synchronicity thing, you know, that a lot of people.
It's a weird thing, yeah, that I just kind of see it places and it fascinates me. In the UK, we've even got loads of companies start using 666 in their telephone numbers, you know, on the sides of vehicles. They go like, call us if you want a taxi on 0800-111-66666, you know, and stuff like that. And you think, why are they doing that? You know, so I've become fascinated with that number because it pops up in places and, you know, people shouldn't be into that sort of stuff. And that is negative, dark stuff, which I'm not into. But hey ho, guess what? My old magazine used to be called Truth Seekers Review, and unfortunately Truth Seekers was taken on YouTube, so I called it Truth Seekers 666 because everyone says we must be negative. I'm not actually negative, but if you don't scratch beneath the surface, you aren't going to find out what I'm really about.
And I get that, and I totally get that. But I think it also feeds into this other part of your background that I think puts a really interesting spin on things that a lot of people, I think, gloss over. I know I did. And even when I heard that you started out as a paranormal investigator and a UFO investigator, I guess I just kind of missed that in the story. And I go, yeah, but he's hooked up with all these skeptics, right? Because these hardcore dogmatic skeptics who are very vocal, even though they're a relatively small group, have really latched on to the work of the circle makers and have said, look, guys, here is proof. This whole UFO phenomena is more woo-woo. It's just more fake stuff by stupid people.
But when you really listen to what you're saying and what you've said for a number of years, this isn't just something you've latched on to lately, is you're pointing people to the larger phenomena and trying to understand it from the perspective of the paranormal. So how do you feel about being used by the skeptical UFO denier kind of crowd? I mean, I guess that it seems like in one way you're just kind of like, hey, you know, I'm just giving the information. People can use it as they want. But in another way, I guess, how do you feel about that?
Well, I suppose in a ironic sense, perhaps it's slightly funny to look at my situation as being that I'm hated by the people who believe crop circles are made by aliens. And you know, they say, well, people can't make them. So I'm hated by those guys. But then the skeptics who would like to kind of say, oh, look, you know, Matt Williams is saying they're made by people and he can prove it. So therefore, you know, everyone who believes in that is crap. And then when they dig beneath the surface, they find out, well, actually, I believe in the paranormal and I believe in these things, which doesn't go along with some sort of hardcore skeptics. So, you know, I'm kind of hated from both directions, really. That's kind of ironic. But yeah, I mean, my whole time involved in paranormal research has told me there is definitely something else going on. There are ghosts, there are UFOs that people see. People have strange experiences that can't be explained in their lives. I came into this as more of a skeptic than people would think. And I had experiences which told me there was something going on. And then hanging around in Wiltshire, looking at the crop circles, I got drawn into making them to kind of test the water to see what people would think about this. And I had the strangest thing happen to me that I literally didn't expect, which was that paranormal things started happening because we were making the crop circles. And this is the hardest thing to get across to both camps, because the skeptic side, you know, they just want to say, well, it's humans, isn't it? So therefore, case closed. And I've always been telling people, no, the fact that humans make them is not case closed, because unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you want to look at it, we're having strange experiences, and the people who visit the circles afterwards are having strange experiences. Some people claim, although I'm not too sure about some of these, quote, scientific research claims, that there are strange measurable effects in the formations. I'm not so sure about that as a scientific standpoint. I think there's been a lot of hokey research done, fake scientists, fake doctors, fake professors. There's a lot of fakery. Unfortunately, you know, I wish I didn't have to say this, but I mean, it's easily provable that there's a lot of people who come forward claiming to be at the pinnacle of crop circle research, and their backgrounds are really dodgy.
Well, not only are their backgrounds dodgy, but their methods are dodgy. And even if their methods aren't dodgy, science, as we know, and we've investigated on this show, and we talked a little bit about last time when we were talking like about Rupert Sheldrake, even the most basic scientific experiment takes a lot of skill and, I guess, cleverness to understand how to properly set the controls, but also just how to properly establish what the scientific question is that you're answering. So what I sense from looking at some of the material that you've put out is that a certain degree of frustration with not just the methods that these guys are going about using, but also the questions that they're framing and they're asking. And I think that's a very legitimate complaint for you to ask. And I think you've done actually everyone a service by kind of putting forth that and saying, hey, what assumptions are y'all making by even undertaking this quote unquote crop circle research? Why are you looking in that direction and why not look in this direction?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm glad you're sort of getting the bigger picture. It does take a while of looking at videos by myself and other people, and you've really got to get past this these gut instincts that people, I've seen it for many years, lots of people have these very knee-jerk gut instinct reactions when they see humans making the circles. It angers people. And, you know, they think, well, this is obviously the government trying to disinform, and obviously I must take a stand against this. So what they do is they kind of look around, and the researchers are telling them what they want to hear, I think is probably the best way to put it. You know, they're giving people exactly what they want to hear. And unfortunately, that message, there has to be a good guy and there has to be a bad guy. And the, right. the good guys are always the researchers, you know, come to us, we've got the answers, but don't trust those bad guys. The bad guys, the people who claim they make the circles. Well, the real truth, if people want to find out the truth, is that people make the circles, but there's a bigger story behind it. And if people want to prove me wrong, I've always said the easiest way to find out whether Matt Williams is telling you a load of lies is to go out and make one under real conditions and don't tell anybody. Just let the press, let the researchers, let the locals, let the, you know, whoever comes, let them say what they want to say, experience what they want to experience. And you know the truth then. You don't have to necessarily reveal that you made that circle. You can keep it secret. If you do reveal you made it, you'll probably get a load of hate for that. You'll probably get a lot of people denying that you did it, you know, trying to discredit you, looking into your background and trying to dig stuff up on you to kind of throw dirt at you. This is how crop circles work, unfortunately. But when you do that, when you actually become a circle maker, you'll think to yourself, well, hey, you know, I could either continue making circles. You might start having some paranormal stuff happen to you. Or you can do what I did. And as a paranormal researcher, you can say, hey, I think people need to know about this. I think people need to have the truth on this. They don't have to accept it. Most, I would say, probably 3/4 of the people who are interested in crop circles will come across the human circle maker stuff. And they'll go, nope, not interested in that. Pull away. All I'm glad for is the opportunity to tell it from a historical point of view so that it doesn't get drowned out by all the, you know, hysterical believer camp stuff, so that the other side is put forward. And, you know, to me, I think it's like natural land magic. I think that somehow, and I don't understand the mechanism, this is why I find it so fascinating. There's a mechanism when you get involved in crop circles. You don't understand why it works, how it works. You just know it works. And things start happening and you go, wow, this is really great. And synchronicity start happening, you know, paranormal stuff, all sorts of stuff will start happening. You can't tell people this stuff because they'll think, well, you're a crazy, you know, what the hell are you on about? You know, you say you make circles, which, you know, and then you're saying all this paranormal stuff's happening. And you just have to say to people, try it. Try it.
You know, even in what you just said there, which was very succinct and well said, but there's still a lot to pull apart there, and there's some subtleties there that I think are going to escape people. One thing that I want to explore is, there is this underlying cultural thing going on as well. When you talk about investigating crop circles initially, and your initial investigations led you to the circle makers, you know, like we said, you're a Welshman. You're from an area where a lot of these crop circles popped up. And so you go and start investigating them, and you have a little bit of a different orientation. I mean, these things are on your soil. And when you rub elbows with the guys in the pub who may or may not be associated, I just get the sense that you instinctively knew how to navigate that territory, maybe a little bit different than Nancy Talbot from the United States, or Suzanne Taylor, or Linda Moulton Howe, these women from the United States with a different orientation, a different worldview. Not to put that down, but we just have to be honest. I mean, there's a cultural difference in the way you went about approaching the truth that you found and pursued versus the way that some of these crop circle researchers, their truth and the way they went uncovering that. So let's talk about that first, and then let's also talk about the paranormal and this natural land magic thing. But first, just talk, is there anything to maybe some cultural differences in these two groups?
Yeah, well, I think people have this impression of me, which I would agree with, that I am maybe slightly bombastic. I like a good rant. You know, I seem to have like a, I think my dad describes it. He says, you're very highly strung. And that's been polite, you know. But what I describe it as to people is where I come from in Wales, people have a very bombastic, playful attitude. If you like somebody, you speak to them in a, you know, a manner that kind of puts them down a little bit as a joke, you know, and they do the same to you. You know, you're constantly bouncing off each other with sort of rude, nasty, loud jokes. And, you know, they play rugby, which is like American football, you know, but it's supposed to be a bit more dark and dirty than American right. football. You know, the type of place I come from is where people like, you know, physically nasty games, you know, and the way they get the tension out of their system is they play on a field, a sports field, and they kick the shit out of it. Oops, sorry. So they do that to each other. And basically, so if you live in an environment like that, you're used to kind of like high tension, high octane conversations. And I suppose I'm not offended by people being different, having different points of view. I like the art of debate. I think the whole point of debate is about people with differences coming together to talk, to put the ideas forward, to bounce them off, to see what makes sense. Now, a lot of people involved in paranormal research, I think, certainly with crop circles, they don't have this debate concept going there. They say they do. They say, oh, look, we put conferences on and it's all about finding out the truth, yet it's only one-sided. It's like there's only people who are going to talk about why circles are real and made by aliens, and there's never any circle makers invited. There's no debate. I mean, I can count on over 20 years how many times I've been invited to, you know, enemy territory, as it were, to discuss this stuff. And I mean, when people actually see me debating this stuff and talking, and they can sit down, have a drink, we can just sit there and chat, I'll answer the questions, they come away with a very different impression of me, and that I'm not an enemy. Now, that in itself, I think, is one of the reasons that we're kept at bay, because we would probably give people this different impression if people just got to kind of meet us and speak to us. Now, there are some circle making groups out there that have, they actually play on the keeping the sense of mystery and cloak and dagger going. It's part of what they consider to be their art form. It's not everyone who's out there making circles. It's not their idea of how it should be done. So when some people encounter certain circle-making teams, and they ask them pointed questions about, well, what about this formation and what about that formation? They will, on purpose, they will actually say, oh, yeah, we couldn't make that one. No, definitely not. No, you know, and then people say, yeah, see you. So I got you. And they're going like, you know, well, yeah, you ain't got me. And they'll get up and walk away like as if, oh, you know, they have got them. You know, they actually foster and pretend and play. It's almost like theater for them. The whole crop circle thing for them is making a crop circle, a really good one, and then pretending like, well, actually, yeah, that's the one we couldn't have made. That's too good for us, you know, but then putting photos of that same formation up all over their websites, pretending that, you know, well, look, we might be doing that. And when people ask them about it, they go, no, we could never do that. Now, this is the problem, is I don't play games like that. And unfortunately, people get a very schizophrenic view of what the circle making scene is about, because when they see some teams talking about it, they get this weird kind of, you know, are they, aren't they? And when they see me talking about it, I try to be as straightforward as I can. So they say, well, why is Matt like that? Why are they like this? How come? They assume we're all part of one big team. Absolutely not. You're dealing with individuals.
This is an information, misinformation shaper's dream. So if anyone is out there trying to muddy the waters in terms of the what we really know about this phenomena, what we're investigating about this phenomena, you couldn't script it any better. I mean, you just have all this craziness going on. Mm. But that kind of gets me into the next part of what I wanted to pull apart from there. And that's talking about the paranormal, because I do think in what you're saying, there are different shades of interpretation that people can go with that. You know, you just mentioned you suspect at the end of the day it's some kind of natural land magic. Well, what I thought might be useful is because you are so connected with this phenomena, let's go through some of what you believe in terms of the paranormal, what you've found out, and just see, and I don't know the answer to some of these, so it'll be information for me about where you sit. So first of all, UFO, unidentified flying objects. Yes or no? You've observed them, yes or no? You believe in them, yes or no? Taking apart for a second what their origin is, what their purpose is, any of that. UFOs, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Seen them. Don't understand what they are. Have not seen any aliens, but I've seen plenty of UFOs. And I've seen what I could consider to be semi-structured shapes. I've seen little balls of light flying along the countryside, going up into a saucer shape that was probably about a mile wide, which by itself, it was hovering over a village and would have been a mile wide. How could people not see this? But
right.
We saw it, you know.
Right. So something, you know, as the UFO community likes to say, if you had to be forced into a choice of nuts and bolts versus consciousness phenomena, it sounds like you felt there was a physical component to it, a nuts and bolts component to it, not discounting the consciousness component that might be there, but there was a nuts and bolts component to what you've seen.
Yeah, and the trouble is to me as well that I see a lot of people misidentifying things that I've come to know because I've done so much sky watching and I live in this area. And you get outsiders come in, they see flares and they go UFO. They take a video of it, stick it on YouTube. And then we have to say, no, it's actually a flare. And then you get into these arguments. I'm quite proud of being a good video analyst and I can take apart videos. I can see fake ones straight away. I can always tell, you know, if somebody's been messing around with CGI. But, you know, Wiltshire is a high activity area, but you've also got the military here and you've got to separate. You've got to draw a line between these things. People do get very offended when you analyze their footage and you come back with an answer, which isn't the one they want, which is, you know, yes, go forth and multiply and sell this footage for millions of pounds. You know, and it's like, well, you explain it to them and you say, well, it's this. And it kind of brings things back down to earth. People are not after that. But like, well, let's go back to the point. I mean, I'm digressing here. The point is, yes, I've seen lots of things.
Thanks again to both Nancy Talbot and Matthew Williams for joining me today on Skeptico. As I mentioned previously, I will have links in the show notes to both of the full interviews as well. You can also find excerpts from these interviews that you can read if you wanted to quote anything or anything like that. That, of course, is at the Skeptico website, skeptiko.com. Be sure to visit there, drop me a line, shoot me over a Facebook post or something, share me on Facebook. Love to see that. It's a great way for people to get to know about the show. And join me on the Skeptico Forum if you'd like to discuss this further. And since I usually tee up a question for the Skeptico Forum, I guess I should do that now. The question I'd have is, where do we go from here with regard to crop circle research? So I may not like Nancy's science, but do we push forward with that kind of approach, looking for anomalies, physical anomalies with crop circles and crop circle formations? Do we explore the paranormal aspect of it that Matt Williams is doing? Or do we take the default position, the position that we're in right now, which is to do no research in crop circles, to take the evidence from the circle makers, the human man-made circle makers we have, and therefore conclude that there's nothing here, folks. Move on. Disregard all the other evidence we have of UFO sightings, of alien contact, of government cover-up and misinformation. Hey, that's an idea. Maybe we could use this whole crop circle thing to debunk the UFO phenomena. Okay, sorry for the sarcasm there at the end, but you get the point. There's a tangled web of questions that we might want to pull apart on the forum, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on any or all of those questions. While you're at the website, be sure to subscribe. You can also subscribe to the newsletter, get updates. You can download any of the previous 300 shows for free. All that's there. I hope you take advantage of it, but mostly I hope you continue to listen, enjoy the show, and use it in any way you think it might be useful to you. So that's going to do it for today. I have a number of interesting shows coming up. I sure hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.
It is fight for a new world, a decent world.